Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Coffee Clash. This is Marianne Russo. I'd like to acknowledge my co-moderators, Elise, Pierrette, Jane, and Chuck, who is on our Tweet Chat tonight. We're doing something a little bit different. We're going to be having our Blog Talk Radio interview with our guest tonight, Elaine Hall. We will be taking your calls. And then Elaine and I are going to jump on Tweet Chat and interact with all of you parents. So this is a first for us, and we're very excited. This Elaine Hall has written a book, Now I See the Moon. And I mean, this book is just so inspirational on so many different levels. And it's not just for the improvement that all of her efforts made in her son, but also for the way that she turned her own personal adversity into just a wonderful life for the both of them. So I really am so happy to bring Elaine to you tonight. Let me read a little excerpt from the book. I believe in miracles. I rely on them. I see them everywhere, every day. When it comes to miracles, parents of kids with special needs are the lucky ones. Our kids may never attend the best public schools or elite universities, but we can find a miracle in every one of their accomplishments, however small or great. And in this book, that is what you find, that miracles happen in many different ways. So, Elaine Hall, thank you for coming.
I am so excited to be here and to be part of the Coffee Clatch. What an amazing technology, what you've created. It's just really, really awesome, really wonderful.
Oh, thank you very much. I love the book, and we spoke for a minute or two while we were in queue before, and you know, I just feel like we're kindred spirits. But I want to start with, I mean, this book really is the entire journey that you've had, and you know, it brings into it, you know, your background, your family. So why don't we just start very briefly with, you know, before you adopted your son Neil, and you adopted Neil from Russia, and you were an acting coach for children. And do you remember your first life?
So long ago, my past life.
Right.
Yeah, I was an A-list Hollywood acting coach. I dealt with the biggest and brightest Hollywood stars, up and coming kids. I had the privilege to work with I've worked with Elizabeth Taylor. I've worked with I worked on the movie The Flintstones with Rosie O'Donnell, and it was a fun life. It really was a fun life. I was kind of known as the child whisperer because I was able to work with very young children as well as teenagers to help them navigate the strange and bizarre world of being on a Hollywood set. The two of the kids were on a show called Grace Under Fire. They were babies at the time, and now some of you may know them on The Suite Life of Zach and Cody. So, I really felt that everything that I did and learned when working on sets is what brought me to the understanding and being able to work with autism. Because
it's incredible. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, when I see, you know, it's like everything is, you know, for a reason, and it's just incredible how, you know, you used that career to, you know, create this amazing miracle project, and we'll get into that later.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know,
mm-hmm.
I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, yourself and your background so that I think everybody can understand. I mean, you write of all the struggles that so many parents of special needs children go through, and, you know, you give hope, and it's just so important. So, I mean, you have had a very strong bond with your father and, you know, your Jewish heritage. And I think, you know, like many others, you know, the family acceptance and the faith is difficult to achieve. And I really enjoyed reading that about the book because you're very open and honest about everything.
Thank you. Yeah, I felt, you know, when there's nowhere to turn, for me the only way to turn was inward and upward, and to ask the God of my understanding to show me what the next step was. It was sort of like walking on a tightrope. My friend and colleague Barry Prezant shows in his PowerPoint presentation, he shows a tightrope where the only way that the next step of the tightrope appears is once you've made that step. And I think that's sort of a really metaphor for being a parent of a child with special needs, because you really don't know what the next step is until you take the step, until you make that,
right.
that little step of faith. So, my faith has been a real grounding for pretty much everything that I've done.
And you needed it because you adopted this beautiful little boy, Neil, from Russia. And, he was very severe on the autism spectrum. And he also had apraxia and, severe sensory issues. And, you were told what so many parents are told, the gloom and the doom, no hope, more than likely he would need residential care. And, you didn't accept it like a lot of other parents don't accept it. I mean, do you remember when you went through that?
Yes, it's so far away, yet it feels like yesterday. And I think, it's what we all go through. And pioneers like yourself, Marianne, and, all of us that have older children, we really didn't know what was going on. I mean, today, fortunately, there's places like the Coffee Clutch and other, organizations, Autism Speaks and Autism Society of America has always been around, but we didn't know about these things. And so really was being in the dark at those times. And the only thing that kept me going was just a real inner conviction that he's my son, he's whole, he's perfect in who he is, and I just need some help in getting him to be the best that he can be. And because he had come from an institution, I mean, he spent the first 2 years of his life institutionalized in an orphanage in Russia, I just did not want to have that be his life for him. So, yeah.
And, you wrote how you saw the innate intelligence in him, and you saw the potential in him that a lot of people didn't see, and, a lot of parents say that. And I don't know if that's out of love or if it's just this sense that parents have. But, before I told you, to me, when I read your book, I felt like we were kindred souls.
Yeah.
I also feel that some of our kids are old souls, and they're here to teach us lessons on our true purpose. And it's always amazing to me whenever I read, or hear about anyone's journey, how profound the change was to their priorities and to their view on life. And, I don't say that to glorify having a child with special needs. I'm just saying it changes you. And depending how you look on it, it can change you for the better. And, that's
Absolutely.
A very strong message that you give in the book. Now, you write in the book about the impact on your marriage and, divorce rates are so high among special needs families. What happened?
I feel that autism puts Miracle-Grow on an already distressed situation. Because I've seen some of the most intact, beautiful relationships with autism, and I think if a relationship has communication and kindness with each other and shared values, that autism is going to be a stumbling block, but it's not going to be what's going to cause the marriage to end. And that a relationship that's already on shaky ground, perhaps you put that, Miracle-Grow or whatever on the defects, and they just become more pronounced and more, more intense, I think that's really what happens. So,
You wrote something in there that really struck me. You had said, you were unsure why it was that you could accept Neil as he was, but not your husband. And, I mean, I think that's just so common that, we're so, I guess it's the unconditional love. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's it. That was something I really needed to know. I didn't want to accept the things that were in my husband, because if I did, I wouldn't have been able to stay in the marriage, because there were things that did not equate with my own personal values. And so by keep trying to make him be different than who he was, I didn't have to have the courage to do what was necessary, which was to change my situation. And I don't speak for everyone, but as long as I was trying to change him to make me happy, then I couldn't live in the reality that, no, the only one that can make me happy is me.
And, you know, when I was reading that, I just, you know, I hear it so many times from so many parents that, you know, it's difficult having a child with, you know, severe disabilities and the marriage is affected. And for fear or for whatever reason, a lot of people don't leave when maybe they should leave. And, you know, a lot of people maybe, you know, leave when they should have tried to work it out. But I just, in reading what you wrote, it just really shows that it isn't something that was, you know, impulsive, and the journey and, you know, all of the emotions you had to go through to get to the point until you were strong enough to leave and do what was best for you and for Neil. So, you know, it's good that you write things like that, because people need to understand they're not alone.
I think so. And my husband and I, we tried. I mean, we went to therapies. We went to so many things. We really, really did try. And we just weren't supposed to be together. I'm not at all a proponent for divorce. I mean, I tried for many, many years. We both tried to make it work. And I truly, strongly believe to do every single thing you possibly can. But then when it's not working, it's just not working.
Right.
So, yeah.
You know, I wanted to start moving on to really the crux of it, because I have to say, I mean, I was exhausted just reading everything that you did. I mean, I'm not kidding. I don't know how you did it. But, you know, before I get in that, I just wanted to, you know, go through with you, you know, that it was so familiar, your writing about, you know, what I call the moment. And I think every parent has the moment. You know, the moment is when it hits you. The realization of what you have before you slaps you in the face, and you cry and you grieve, and, you know, you feel everything you need to feel before you can move on.
Yeah.
You know, and you wrote about that so beautifully also.
Yeah, when I got the diagnosis, I grieved, and we have this little swimming hole in my little townhouse where I live in Los Angeles, and I went to the pool every night, and I just grieved, you know. What I grieved, though, and this is what hit me, is I didn't grieve my son. I adored my son. I loved all his quirks and everything. Nothing really bothered me. What I grieved was my vision of what I thought I wanted and needed as a child. And it was my vision of what normal was. You know, it was, you know, I write about it in Now I See the Moon, that all I ever craved was normal. And, you know, soccer mom and PTA and all of those kinds of things. And I grieved that dream. And I think it was really important to get to that place. And then one day I looked at my reflection in the pool and I was like, okay, enough already. And got on the internet and just started seeing what this was all about, and then got into action.
But
I think it's important to have the feelings. You know, it's sort of like awareness, acceptance, and then action. Because I think if I had jumped right into action, I would have missed that integral part and the authentic part, which is the sadness.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because, you know, for myself, I remember it. I mean, when I speak with parents, it's just such a key moment. I mean, I can tell you exactly where I was. I was on a couch that we used to have, a big chaise lounge couch I had in my living room. We used to call it the snuggle couch, because every morning the kids would all come downstairs and I'd be on the snuggle couch and they'd all jump on it. And I can just remember being strong, going to the doctors, and then just having my breakdown and just sobbing. And I can remember maybe a year or two after the fact, I said, throw that couch out. I didn't even want to look at it. Because I got past it. But I can and I think every parent can remember that moment, you know. But, I mean, you got over it, and your determination, as I say, was, as I was reading it, it was exhausting. I mean, the amount of time and thought and creativity that you put into your son's home therapy was incredible. So you got great advice early on. You were fortunate because you saw Dr. Greenspan.
Yeah.
Let's hear about what Dr. Greenspan had told you to do and how you put your spin on it.
Well, yeah, I when you say his name, my heart feels sad. As you know, Dr. Stanley Greenspan passed away a couple months ago, and I'm actually going to be speaking at his conference in November. And I was going, when we got the diagnosis, I like to say I was sentenced to this preschool that was like a baby version of the movie Snake Pit, you know, the kids were in helmets and banging their head, and there were like these all these rules and rigidity and bells going off, and it really felt horrible to me. And fortunately, the people who were running the preschool learned about Dr. Stanley Greenspan's methods and said, "We're doing everything wrong for your son. You need to go meet this person." And I did. I flew to Bethesda, Maryland, and was able to get an appointment with Dr. Greenspan. And rather than put Neil through a battery of tests, can he stack this block, can he, you know, thread this needle, he just observed and then coached me playing with Neil. And he he encouraged the play, but more than anything is he was the first person to see Neil's intelligence and all the things that I was seeing that people thought I was crazy about. He saw them too. And he told me something that I think was the most important lesson, was that there isn't just a window of opportunity. There are all kinds of windows. I kind of took that into being that there's a skyscraper of opportunity in terms of the learning. Like, just because a child doesn't speak when they're 3 or 4 or 10 or whatever doesn't mean they'll never speak. And he likened it to a 70-year-old that can learn to play the guitar. They're always creating new pathways. So he gave me a tremendous amount of hope. And he also provided a model, which he is now called DIR, Developmental Individualized Relationship-Based Intervention, where the relationship with the child is paramount. And through that relationship, all learning can happen. So from Dr. Greenspan, I learned how to follow Neil's lead. And a lot of people misinterpret that. They think that means that you're just, you know, be random with the child, but it's not. It's seeing every single seemingly bizarre behavior as being extremely purposeful. And to really observe it and see from the perspective of the child. And what I was saying earlier on is how my world as a kids coach prepared me for this. Well, that's what I had to do when I worked in film and TV. I had to go into a set, get down, and I'm very teeny. I'm only 4'9". Well, I said the truth. I said 4'9". Sometimes I say 4'10". But anyway, I would get to see the world through Neil's perspective and really learn how he was perceiving the world, and his behaviors then made perfect sense. Perfect sense.
And, you know, I don't know, the floor time program, I assume, is Dr. Greenspan's. Am I correct in that?
Yes, floor time. Yeah, it was called floor time originally. Yes.
Floor time. And then sunrise. Yes. What is the difference between sunrise and floor time? Because you use the sunrise therapy method. And, you know, in your case, I mean, you know, we've had Dr. Grandin on and other people that have really, really stressed that one-on-one early intervention is key, and that relationship and that understanding. And, you know, you just took this to a whole new level. So first, if you could just tell us what the difference is between sunrise and floor time, and then I want to go into this incredible group of coaches that you had put together for him.
Yeah. Floor time at the time, this was, you know, 14 years ago, was really developed in a clinical model. So mainly, you know, therapists were doing it, and they really didn't have in place a strong parent piece. Now today they do. They have a very, very strong parent piece. What the Sunrise people did for me was they really, and I hate to use, it's an overused term, but they empowered the parents to take hold of their child's program and to learn how to build a community around the child and to set up a playroom. We set up a room where there were no no's. And so we set up a playroom in the Sunrise concept and then used floor time inside that playroom. We also used a lot of the methods.
We're going to get into that playroom. That's incredible. It's incredible. Please, everybody that's listening, just don't go anywhere. It really is very impressive. You know, but you also brought on, you know, in your case, it took a village. You had a lot of coaches that came in. I don't know how many you had and how many hours a day each, but, you know, my question was, how did you afford all of this care? And, you know, not only did, you know, all of these coaches that were just so amazing with him, and they really, you know, took your cue, not only did they give Neil the incredible one-on-one that he needed, but, you know, it probably saved your sanity also because you had, you know, breaks that you could regroup. So how did you find these coaches? What was the purpose of the coaches? And how were you able to afford this coaching staff?
Yeah, and these are the things that the Sunrise people helped me with tremendously. Well, first of all, what I found is if when I was joining Neil's world and really relating to him one-on-one and really helping him, joining his world and bringing him into my world, he was, as Dr. Greenspan would say, he was cooking. He was showing emotion and really doing beautifully. But then that would be maybe 2 hours or something, and then he would go back in his own world. So my thought was, well, if this works 2 hours a day, what if we were doing this all day long? So that he was never retreating into his own world. And people thought I was crazy. I got to tell you, Marianne, people thought I was a Looney Tunes. But it made sense to me. You know, people say, oh, you're working him too hard. Well, no, because if I didn't keep him in this world, then he would be gone, you know, completely isolated in his own space. So the traditional therapist at the time thought that I was really crazy. And kind of didn't want to work with me or my son. So I went back to what I know best, which is all my theater people. And I had a theater company called Kids on Stage, which is still going on in Los Angeles. And I went to the teachers there, and I said, look, you know, can you come? And I'm going to train you. I'm going to have a speech therapist train you in speech therapy, and an occupational therapist, you know, train you in occupational therapy so that whatever he did in his intensive therapy once a week with these professionals, we would incorporate throughout the entire week. And I would trade. You say, how did I afford it? I was just whatever. When I was a youngster and I was, you know, needed to take dance lessons, I would, you know, do whatever it took to get the money that did the dance classes. What I did with this was I did exchanges where I would train actors how to get a job in the entertainment industry in exchange for working 6 hours a week with Neil. I would find, and anyone, you guys, you can all do this. I went to the local colleges, and I put out flyers and said, found people who needed therapy hours and would get they'd be supervised by a therapist if they gave me 4 to 6 hours a week of volunteering in my program. I spoke at special education classes and said, hey, do you guys want to learn this phenomenal program, floor time, you know, and I had a floor time specialist train them. And so these new educators learned floor time and worked with me 4 to 6 hours a week. So I just kind of accumulated hours. I had kids.
What a difference it made for him also, having different people in his life. I mean, it turned out to really just be, you know, open a whole new world for him. And, you know, I want to move on just for time's sake because we still have a lot to go through. But this playroom was really a special place. I mean, you know, most people have a playroom. But, you know, I want to go into it because some of it I didn't really understand and most of it I just was just in awe of. But the playroom was really a place that was his world, if I'm correct, that you entered. It was a place for him to interpret the world in his world, but yet you would bring the real world into it very slowly and gently. And, you know, it was just an incredible place. So tell us about the playroom.
The playroom, and this was developed by the Sunrise people, there was a room of no-nos, basically. Really, whatever, if Neil wanted to run around naked, he could run around naked in that room. But if he wanted to be in the rest of the house, he needed to put clothes on. So it gave him the opportunity to choose to be in our world. And the more that he had the opportunity to be in that world and we were okay with it, gradually he wanted to be more and more into our world. The other things we would do there is Neil would go through different stages. He went to a stage where he needed to hang things everywhere. And he would hang chairs on top of chairs on top of chairs. So in this playroom, we started with, you know, plastic chairs that he could hang, and then hanging things on the walls, and we put hooks all around the playroom so he could hang things. And then we gradually turned that into learning how to hang up his clothes. And then we made collages that were hanging things. So we turned whatever it is he was doing into something that was more appropriate. He would throw things. We got all kind of cushy soft balls and soft stuffed animals and let him randomly throw. And then we put a net up in the room, and he would we taught him how to throw over a net and how to throw into a basketball and how to aim at targets. And then we turned that into learning the letters of the alphabet, like, okay, throw at the letter A. And he would throw at the letter A, and we'd go, yay. And so gradually we would take what would be seemingly unacceptable behavior and help transform it into very practical, usable skills.
And, you know, a lot of the role play that you did with him was actually, you know, as I was reading it, exposure and response, you know, which we do with children like my daughter who has obsessive compulsive disorder. A lot of the role play and the playing that was done was really desensitizing him to the outside stimuli.
Absolutely. Absolutely. For example, if we needed to go on an airplane, we would take 2 weeks and we would practice airplane. So he would pretty much know every single thing that we needed to do before we ever, ever walked onto a real airplane. We would have books about airplanes. We would pretend play going on an airplane. We'd have a seatbelt that you put on. We'd pretend walking down the aisle so that we'd show video so that by the time he had to experience, we taught him to put his hands over his ears when it got too loud. So he was able, we call it, you know, rehearsing for life. We'd rehearse for life first, so that when he was in the actual world, we did the same thing with going to the doctor or going to the dentist. We would pretend play it out so that when he was in that environment, his neurosystem was already adjusted and could already make some sense out of it.
And, you know, it made me, because it's just so typical in our lives. I mean, you know, everybody out here listening can relate to this. No matter how much you do, no matter how proactive you are, it's always that one thing that you forget. And I actually laughed. I know it wasn't funny for you, but I laughed when I read how, you know, you had all this preparation for the flight and you forgot to prepare him about if he had to go to the bathroom.
Right.
And it was just like, oh, I just was like, I really fell for you, you know. But, you know, everything that you did, it was like even going to the sand, if you wanted to go on the sand because he didn't like to go, you know, outside. You know, it was really very smart because you were desensitizing him to things that he needed to be, you know, exposed to. And, you know, you are a brave soul. I mean, you continued to, you know, take Neil to dinner parties and family events, you know, even though his behaviors at times were a danger to himself or others. You know, where many parents choose to stay home and isolate themselves, you still kept reintroducing him to social situations.
Yeah, I felt that it was important to let him know what the world was like, and we would do it in small increments so that when he would get overstimulated, he'd have the choice. It was all about choice, really giving him the choice that this is how this world is, and we'd love you to be part of it, but this is how we act, and this is what we do in this world, and really giving him a choice to be part of it.
Well, does that go back, because I remember when I spoke before about the playroom, which is, like, I'll say it again, it was incredible. It was even sensory friendly. I mean, the things that you did in there, everybody really needs to read the book because there's just so much information that we can't possibly, you know, get out in a short period of time tonight. But in this room, in his playroom, he could rage and melt down for hours on end, throwing and breaking things. And, you know, as any parent knows with a raging child, you know, during a rage, it is no time to address the behavior. But, you know, I was a bit taken back at how long he would be allowed to rage. What was the reasoning behind that, and what did that help him learn? Did it help him learn modulating his emotions?
Yeah, basically, if I had tried to stop him from raging, then he'd still have all that in him. I mean, when you think about it, Neil, you know, was relinquished at birth. He had no biological parents. he was in an orphanage. I mean, he had a lot to be, he couldn't talk. He, you know, couldn't relate. He had a lot to be angry about.
Angry, frustrated, yeah.
So what we did is we just made it very safe. We had mats. We had these, you know, really soft mats. The whole room was covered in mats. We had big pillows all over the place. And I would just sit there and just say, okay, sweetie, you know, when you're ready to calm down, I'm here. Without any reaction, very flat. I learned this from Dana K. Bonahoom, who is trained by Dr. Greenspan. I would just sit there very calmly and say, okay, when you're ready to stop, you know, being angry, I'm right here. And he would get it all out of his system. Sometimes it would take 2 hours. But he learned himself how to regulate his own body. And he was safe, and I didn't react.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't react. That's the key.
Overreacting and jumping in, he learned self-regulatory tools.
Exactly.
I mean, really, essentially,
learned how to regulate
himself. What wound up happening.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And, you know,
and if he messed up the room and destroyed it and everything, once he was done having his tantrum and was calm, we're like, okay, baby, it's time to clean up.
Yeah, that was impressive. That was impressive that that was part of the deal, you know, and that he understood it. I mean, I think that's, you know, part of it, too. It was your faith in him was amazing. Your ability to see his, you know, like you wrote, his innate intelligence and his abilities and what was behind the behaviors is, you know, what I believe really saves both of you.
Yeah.
So, you know, this approach that you were taught and that you built upon really is so important, because if you can find the purpose in what seems to be completely irrational, you know, that's really what led you to be successful with him.
Well, that's it, exactly. I mean, just hand flapping. Like, there's one thing to tell a child, hands down, but what is the need that they get from hand flapping? Well, if you put your hand in front of your eyes, there's a flickering that you get. And that can either be very calming, if you need to calm yourself down. It can be very stimulating. It can help you to regulate. There's a real purpose for that. So if we could understand that and then provide him with a more appropriate way of achieving that same purpose, then it helps him, again, to regulate and to be in the world.
Right. And you know, you grew together in all of this, which is really another beautiful part of the book, is how, you know, like you said, and you don't know what to do when you first have a diagnosis and a child like this, and they're all different, that, you know, it's a day-to-day thing, but at some point, you know, the realization sets in. The isolation due to the behaviors that, you know, so many experience becomes a reality. And, you know, the understanding that a relationship and extended family will be difficult for you, you wrote about also that you had met this man, you had a very loving relationship, but once Neil was involved with his family, things became very different. And, you know, and then comes my favorite part of the book, because this is, you know, something that I am a really strong believer in, and that is when you write about the acceptance. And it was amazing, because as I was reading your words, I was reading what I had just written, because, you know, we feel the same way, you know. And you write that the true acceptance and the time that you realize that you do not, you came to a point where you realize that you don't need to cure him, that you will never cure him, and that your goal is to give him a happy life. And that's so important. And I think that's in the book where I saw the turning point also.
Mm-hmm. That was it. It was his 8th birthday. And, you know, he still wasn't talking. He was still having, you know, challenges. He was still autistic. And a lot of the early people had said to me, you know, if you do this, 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 your child will no longer be autistic. And I saw people around me whose children, you know, were no longer autistic. And I started thinking, wow, what's going on here? And finally I had to realize that this autism is Neil. And it's not about curing him or fixing him, that he already was whole. And the cure, the healing, was about me. It was about me. It was about I had to heal me and accept this life and this autism life. And when I did, it was such a relief and so profound in my ability to relate to Neil and for myself. Because the healing, I really think these kids are brought here to heal us. Not about me.
Well, you know, I feel that here for, you know, I feel we learn from it, you know, whether they're lessons we need to learn or whatever it is. I mean, I just feel that it makes you a better person, a better woman, a better mother. It just gives you an understanding that I think parents, other parents couldn't possibly imagine. Not that they don't love their children as much as we love ours, but it's just a completely different understanding of life. But, you know,
yes,
to move on, then it became a point of education for Neil. And, you know, they really were restricting him. They were limiting him and did not see his abilities. And, you know, you wrote about how they had him, you know, learning colors and, you know, shapes, you know, up until, like, third grade. And then, you know, another angel came into your life, and this person came into your life, and she opened a whole new world for Neil with the choice board. And I would really like for you to go into that, the choice board, the keyboarding, and the communication, because this is where really his whole life changed.
Yeah, Darlene Hansen is one of those extraordinary human beings that she is a speech pathologist, and her specialty is assisted communication. And she came to us. Neil was, you know, having a hard time in school, you know, put the square peg in the square hole, and he was throwing things. And, you know, at home we were doing a lot more interesting types of things. And she put a choice board out, or just a board, and she drew a grid. And she wrote Washington, D.C., Clinton, Bush, and vote. And she said, who's the president of the United States? And he pointed to Bush. And she said, who was the president of the United States? And he pointed to Clinton. And she said, where do they live? And he pointed to Washington, D.C. And she said, how did they get there? And he pointed to vote. And it was at that moment that I knew, you know, throw away the pegboard. And he started mainstreaming in a typical third grade class with a one-on-one aide, and using the choice board to answer questions and to participate in the class discussions. And that eventually evolved into him typing and being able to communicate very, very deep thoughts through typing. He's typed, God helps me find patience with my autism. He's typed, just recently he told, it was a Jewish holiday, and he typed that this is the time of year to learn how to take care of the drastic self. And he said the drastic self is sad because we are imperfect. We think we need to be perfect, but only God is perfect. So, yeah, Darlene opened us up to the insides of Neil. And, who
and you know, had you
is.
Not had you not found out about that, and had you not had this woman who did bring the choice board, and you used the choice board from then on. I mean, that was what was, you know, basically, I'm sorry, I forgot her name.
Darlene Hansen, yeah.
Yes, when she brought the board is when you realized and when you were able to show the school his abilities.
Yes.
But, and that is basically what got him to go into mainstream and to get him to the point that he's at now. But you
yeah.
used that choice board in many different situations when, you know, at home and in the rest of his life. And, you know, it made a difference. So, you know, as I said, everybody, you really need to get this book because Now I See the Moon just has so many things in it that could really help your children. You know, and it's at this time that you found yourself really in a very desperate financial situation. I mean, you were to the point that you didn't know if you would be homeless or how you would care for Neil and, you know, friends and family. I mean, just before this, actually, you know, friends and family were urging you to find a home for him. I mean, you know, how did that make you feel? You know, I remember you wrote that you used to doubt yourself and say, just, am I in complete denial? So, I mean, you know, how did you feel then? And looking back on it, I mean, how do you feel about, you know, the doubt that everybody had in you and in Neil?
It was probably the roughest time of my life. I guess, you know, the dark night of the soul. But within it, I kept having this voice inside of me that just said, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. And I had to reach out and ask for help, which I had never done before. I mean, so many of us are the caretaker type of people. And I had to really ask for help in so many ways. And the amazing thing is whenever I asked, the help was there. I was on the verge of homelessness. I was deeply in debt. My it was a single mom. I hadn't worked in 7 or 8 years, and I didn't want to leave Neil. I didn't want to work, but I knew I needed to, and I didn't know what to do. I prayed a lot. I just prayed a lot, and this inner voice just kept telling me everything was going to be okay. I hate to say this, I'm embarrassed to say this, but I had all these 0% credit cards because I had perfect credit, you know, prior. And I just started, I had this voice that said, Elaine, one day you'll be able to make money again, but right now you can't. So use these credit cards. That's what I did. I lived on my 0% credit cards. I sold all the furniture in my house. I sold jewelry. I sold clothes. I sold everything just to
be
able to.
Are you back in that house, actually? That was something in the book that bothered me. Are you back in that in your home now?
Well, actually, what happened
was, you had to move out, and one of the most heart-wrenching things I read in the book was how Neil when Neil finally got comfortable being outside and used to go for walks, he would always lead you back to the old neighborhood, which I thought was amazing that he even had that ability. But
Yeah, Marianne, he still does. We moved into a little townhouse. I had lived in a 5-bedroom, huge, beautiful house. We moved into a little townhouse, and it's home to us, and I love it, and it's, you know, a quarter the size of where I used to live. Well, that's really where the title of the book came from. You know, my barn burned down, now I see the moon. It's like all the things I thought I needed, big house and nice car and fancy lifestyle, I have none of that. You know, I drive a little Honda, I live in a little townhouse, and I have everything. Like my barn burned down, all the big stuff I don't have, but I have truth, I have the essence, I have every single thing that I need, everything I need. And, he still walks me back there. He still walks me back there.
That is so sweet when you write about this swing that you have to read the book, everybody. It's really great. I just want to give the call-in number in case anybody would excuse me, I'm getting over a terrible cold. If anybody would like to call in, the number is 646-595-2881. That's 646-595-2881. And now we're going to get into it. Then came your miracle, the Miracle Project.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Miracle Project is not just a place for children with the disabilities. I mean, this is a community that you've made. I mean, this is a whole community for the special needs family. So take your time and tell us about the Miracle Project. And if anybody would like to call in, now is the time.
Oh, please call in. I'd love to talk to you. When I lost all my finances, I didn't know what to do, and I prayed to God, and I just said, please show me what my next step is. And the voice came very strong inside, teach children with special needs acting, singing, and dancing. And I had never taken a class in special ed. I had no idea what I was doing. And the voice just kept hounding me, teach children with special needs. And a good friend of mine, Michelle Wolf, told me about a grant from the Jewish Community Foundation that, and she said, I'll help you, you know, just write it. Well, she didn't tell me. It was sort of due the next day. But I decided to write this grant, and really the grant wrote me. The concept of the grant, and you know, I talk more about it in the book, but the grant was to what I wrote was to create a theater program for kids with autism and other special needs, to involve their typically developing siblings and peers, to involve the parents in a spiritual support group, not a, you know, real positive support group, and to involve the community to participate. And beginner's luck, I got the grant. And then I was like, oh, no, now I've got to make this thing happen. But fortunately, I called on all my old actor theater friends, and we created what's now known as the Miracle Project. And what it was the same methodologies that I used with Neil, we used with training volunteers how to understand the sensory system, how to love and accept a child for exactly who and where they are, how to follow the child's lead, how to be fully present with the child, and how to scaffold and really guide them to be the best that they can be. And we opened the doors in January 2005, and with 18 kids, and I had our volunteers join the children wherever they were. So if someone needed to hide under a table, we'd have a volunteer go under the table with the child. Or someone needed to run the periphery of the group, we'd have someone run the periphery of the group. Another child wanted to just draw, and so we'd have him draw right in the middle of the class if he loved to draw. And then every time he'd look up and make a connection, we'd go, "You're participating, you're participating." So he would participate for 10 seconds and 20 seconds, and then ultimately he participated for the whole class and then jumped up and said, "I'm participating." We had kids that were completely in their own world, but we found out that they had perfect pitch. So we would teach them songs. They became soloists for the group. The first 11 weeks, there were about, you know, it was all about how do we keep this child from running outside the room? How do we help this child modulate the you know, auditory environment? And it was, you know, problem solving and trying to figure it out. The second 11 weeks, it was all about, okay, what show are we going to do? How are we going to create a show? Who's going to play what characters, what costumes, what theater? And we put on, in 22 weeks, a live musical performance, original, all music, with kids with autism, other special needs, and their typically developing peers. We found one of the best theaters in Los Angeles, and we rented space there. We had a packed house, a full performance. We had a mini movie as part of it, and standing ovation, not a dry eye in the house. And these kids, who had many of them never been in a social situation before, performed live in front of an audience. It was amazing. It was amazing.
And from that, the autism, the musical, correct?
Yes. After that, that year, a group of filmmakers saw what I was doing. And I remember I had no background in special ed, so I didn't know that what we were doing was considered, you know, I guess, undoable, or, you know, not uncommon, I guess, for kids with autism. I didn't know any better. So these filmmakers were saying, "I can't believe you've got these kids making transitions and working together as a group and sitting backstage being quiet and, you know, all these things." And they asked if I would do it again, if they could film it. So I said, "Yeah, sure," not knowing what I was getting into. But the main thing is they have a philosophy. The director, Tricia Regan, is quite extraordinary, as are the producers. And their vision was that they wanted the world to see autism in a different way. And I signed on. And the next season of The Miracle Project is what is now documented in the film, Autism the Musical.
Where did these children come from? How did you find these children? I mean, were these children that had an interest in theater, or were their parents involved in theater, or are these just children that had special needs that for one way or another found your program?
These were children with special needs that for one way or the other found my program. And, you know, I used the same, you know, vigor that I'd used to find coaches, basically. I mean, I put up flyers everywhere and told people about it and said, "Try it out one day and see what you think." And one person brought their son, who has cerebral palsy, but they really just brought, she just couldn't get a babysitter that night. She really just brought her daughter to volunteer. But her son was doing so well that we said, "Can he stay?" And so he became, and he's now a real ham. He's still with us, Danny, and he has cerebral palsy, and he's walking now, and he has lines, and some of his first speaking he ever said was in our play, and now he talks, and it's really been amazing to see the growth of the kids.
Yeah. It is incredible. And how is Neil doing? He's 16 now.
He's 16.
It's been quite the journey,
man.
Huh?
Oh, it's been amazing. He's 16. He's tall. He's a real teenager. Lots of fun. You know, in the book, I talk about how petrified he was to even walk out the door. He was so scared of the world.
Right.
And today, the world is his oyster. I mean, we call him the mayor of Santa Monica. You know, he's really, he knows everybody. He walks all everywhere. We go hiking. He's the best hiker I've ever hiked with. He has an extraordinary visual memory. And so he creates all new paths when we go hiking. And he can get me back because I don't know where I'm going ever. And when it comes to hiking, but he's really amazing. And He just loves life. He's a really happy guy.
Is he involved with the Miracle Project?
He is, but I've had to be really, I've had to not be a smother mother. Neil is much more of an athlete.
Mom.
Yeah, definitely not a stage mom. But he's more of an athlete than he is a performer. And he doesn't like the applause. It hurts his ears. So he comes, he takes classes, but he doesn't have to perform unless he wants to. And often there's sports activities at the same time. And I had to make a choice between should he go to the sports activity or come to class. And he's an athlete, so I definitely let him go to the sports activity. But he comes. I've also created a bar and bat mitzvah program and a religious education, lifelong learning program, social skills program, and he's very much a part of that. He also gave his first presentation. He was a speaker at a assistive technology conference this summer, and he created a PowerPoint presentation that he and my husband, Jeff, created for him, and created not for him, with him. He chose all the pictures. He wrote what he wanted to say. And what he likes is he loves being a leader and he loves being a presenter. So I think he's going to be doing more of that.
Oh, you have to back up.
Okay.
Did you just say my husband, Jeff?
Oh, I got married again.
I
got married.
I know, but you have to understand. It's really a very nice love story also. But you have to understand, Elaine, that I got an uncorrected proof of the book.
Oh.
So I'm missing probably the last four chapters.
Oh,
so
no.
So it's like as I'm listening to you, I didn't even know, I mean, the Miracle Project, how it ended. So how nice. You did wind up with Jeff, who loved you and loved Neil. And, you know, you really went through it all together. So, and what a special guy he is, too. But,
he's a good
you know,
one.
As
he's
be-
a good one.
Yeah, he seemed it. Oh, so happy. This is like, you know, watching a mini-series for me now. But, you know, before we go, I just did want to ask you, what advice would you give to a parent who, you know, has a child who is, you know, going into their other world and, you know, the parents are just so trying to pull them out of it? You know, what advice would you give them?
I would say join them. Go into their world with them. There was a time when Neil, I couldn't walk outside with him. He would stop at every single hubcap and would not walk down the street. And I would like be pulling, come on, we got to go, let's go. And he would stop at every single car, every single hubcap. And so one day I stopped and said, okay, Neil, what are you looking at? And I looked at the hubcap and there were these beautiful shards of light reflection from the sun in the hubcap. Like a kaleidoscope. And I said, oh, my gosh, that's what you've been trying to show me. And I stopped and I sat there and we stared for, oh, gosh, maybe 5 to 10 minutes at these hubcaps and the reflection. And after that, he never needed to stop again.
Yeah,
so
my
thing is go into their world. See what they're trying to tell you. Listen to them. I always say listen to the child that does not speak.
Right, and see through their eyes. We have a caller, Elaine, so before I lose the caller, let me bring them on. Hold on.
Wonderful.
Hi, Elaine.
Hi, this is Eric.
You're giggling. I love giggling.
Hi, Eric.
It's actually my son and my daughter who are around, and I just took the risk to call in. I just love the topic and what Elaine has been you know, what she has done, and I completely agree with the acceptance and the attempt to enter in their world, because, you know, there is an amazing and beautiful coherence in their world, and maybe not falling into place in our world the same way, but they do have an approach to life that is very fascinating, and these, you know, when you start going in their world, you can, you know, be very creative and start building up stories, and that way, you know, help them develop skills that will be able to be applied in real life later on. I'm trying to talk now. My kids are very disruptive around me, so I don't know if I will be able to talk for long.
It's
the
hour for you.
It's the, what I call the happy hour, yeah.
Happy hour, okay, good for you. I used to call it the witching hour. I appreciate you calling in, Eric. I know that you're involved in acting and you're connected to the link. So. Thank you. We have more callers waiting.
Okay. So it was just to stop by, say hi, and love what you're doing. And say what?
I'm going to say hi to you on the chat in a few minutes. We're going to join you on the chat.
Cool. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Let's see who else we have on the line. Thank you. Hi, welcome to the Coffee Clatch.
Hi, Coffee Clatch. This is Tommy from Twitter. How are you?
Hi, Tommy.
Good. How are you?
Okay, y'all know me as Cocky 6969 Leo 24.
Okay, it's good to have a voice with the Twitter name.
I just want to say... Actually, for Elaine, I just want to say thank you. Mm-hmm. I've just now started to really dig into the autism spectrum with having one that's an Aspie, and then I have two more that are ADD, ADHD, and one OCD, one with OCD, and one with bipolar, plus my wife is severe bipolar. And actually... I just want to tell even the Coffee Clatch, thank you. I sit back and I watch sometimes and I read and I read what's going across and, you know, I really can't. I don't have a computer, so I do all of this from my phone. And it's just awesome to have God send people like you out there. And I just wanted to jump in there and say hello real quick.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
It's a hard work.
You tried? I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, ma'am. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, you know, have you, I hope you were able to listen to the show. I mean, a lot of what Elaine did with taking the approach of joining in the world instead of trying to bring the child out. I mean, have you tried that approach with your child? My child didn't have that, so I don't understand it.
Jonathan, we take Jonathan everywhere and anywhere we go. Jonathan is real subject and real prone to a lot of anger meltdowns. We're just now, you know, his mom, it feels very guilty that she did this to him and things like that. And actually, Jonathan is my stepson. Four of these children are my stepchildren, and I've been with them for 7 years. But Jonathan goes everywhere that we go. I don't, you know, Jonathan joins the world. Like right now we're having a problem with him in school. The principal, he understands Aspie children, but there's a coach there that doesn't. And Jonathan is very repetitious. When he wants something, it's can I? And he might stay on this for 2 days. And we're not financially set to, you know, Jonathan wanted to play trumpet. We tried to explain to him, how do you explain to an Aspie, you know, we don't have the funds available for you to play trumpet, son. So apparently he went to school and he said something to his teacher or something. The band director and the principal got together and they decided that they were going to go ahead and let Jonathan play trumpet, but we would be financially responsible if he destroyed it in one of his meltdowns. Jonathan turned around and went bragging to his coach that he was going to get to play trumpet. That was a big thing in his life, you know, and the coach turned around and looked at Jonathan and said, I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear about your garbage. Unlike you, I have to pay for all my children's stuff. Just because you're an Aspie don't mean that you have, just because you're an Aspie don't mean you should get special treatment.
Let me just interrupt you for 1 second. We're about to go off the air, but we're going to stay on because we do have some more callers. Is that okay with you, Elaine?
Yes.
Yeah, I've got about, I can stand probably about 10 more minutes, and then I'm going to have to get to my son.
We're going to stay on, but I do want to thank everyone for joining us. We will be jumping over to the Coffee Clatch, and I'm just going to take one more caller. But I want to thank Elaine before we do go off the air. I appreciate you coming on, and everyone, please, Now I See the Moon, fantastic book. Well, Tim, thank you for calling in. The show is about to go off the air. We're going to take one more caller, and thank you for following us on the Coffee Clatch. I'm glad we've been a support for you.
Thank you. God bless you.
You too. Hi, welcome to the Coffee Clatch. Hello? Hi, are you there? Okay, well, the caller is there, but I don't think they realize they're on the air. So, Elaine, I want to thank you again for joining us.
Thank you so much, Marianne. It was such a pleasure to be with you.
And as we end every show, tonight is no exception. You are your child's best advocate. If not you, then who? Become an informed, educated parent. We are going to jump over to the tweet chat and interact with some of the followers over there. And I want to thank everyone for joining us. I have a very special show Sunday night. Dr. Roya Ostevar is joining me. She is the author of The Ultimate Guide to Sensory Processing Disorder, and I have to tell you, she got that title right. It is The Ultimate Guide. What a fantastic, comprehensive book. So she will be my guest Sunday night, and I thank you for joining us. We're going to jump over to the tweet chat. I'll see you over there, Elaine.
Okay, great.